And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and it's my pleasure to welcome back John Grisham to the program today. Mr. Grisham is, of course, one of the most beloved writers of fiction in the world today, having sold close to 300 million books worldwide, including The Firm, A Time to Kill, Camino Island, and A Painted House, as well as the Theodore Boone series for younger readers. He spent much of his childhood in South Haven, Mississippi, just across the border from Memphis. He recently returned to town to sign copies of his latest novel for Burke's Books, a store which was one of his earliest supporters. His new novel is The Rooster Bar, a thriller about a trio of third-year law school students who take unusual steps to deal with their mountain of student debt, which they built up at a shady for-profit program in Washington, D.C. A little bit later, we'll be joined by Memphis native and best-selling nonfiction author Hampton Sides, who joined Mr. Grisham later in the day for a conversation at Christian Brothers University for an audience of 500 fans. John, we're sitting here in Burke's Bookstore in Memphis, Tennessee, and you have a long relationship with the store, don't you?
Goes back to, 1991, A Time to Kill. I didn't sign A Time to Kill here, but I used to shop at the bookstore. It was on Poplar then. And the first book signing I had was at a friend's house in Hernando, Bill Ballard's house, and Fred and Harriet Beeson, who owned the Burke's Bookstore back then, came to the party. And for some reason, we couldn't get our wire straight on A Time to Kill. And so when The Firm came out in March of 91, I called Harriet Beeson, and we said, let's do a signing. So that was 26 years ago.
Especially with The Firm being set here in town, you had to sign it.
Yes,
town.
I had to sign in Memphis, yes.
Now, there were a handful of stores that you've always signed books for. Mary Gay Shipley store up in Blytheville and
Initially, there were five. Mm-hmm. Burke's in Memphis, Mary Gay store in Blytheville, Square Books in Oxford, Reed's in Tupelo, Lemuria in Jackson. Those five were always every year. Then I added Turn Row Books in Greenwood, Mississippi a few years later. And visited the stores in person every year for signings. And then I got tired of the public signings, so I would go to the stores and sign a pile of books in the back room to make sure. There are a lot of folks in this area who have collected all the books, the signed first editions. And so that's one reason I keep signing. Even today, I don't come to the stores anymore, but I'll always pre-sign 2,000 books for Burke's and any other stores.
And it's amazing how many of those stores actually have writers as owners, with Corey here at Burke's, Jamie Cornegie down at Turn Row, Lisa at Square.
I think it's a trend. Ann Patchett has a store at Parnassus in Nashville. I was in Brooklyn Tuesday night at a store owned by Emma Straub, daughter of Peter Straub, and she's a writer. I don't know if it's a trend, but it seems like more and more writers are getting into retail, I guess, to sell their books.
I know Amy Stewart has a store out in Eureka, California.
Right, right.
Now let's turn to the new book. The Rooster Bar opens up with a third-year law student, Mark Frazier. He's having a very unhappy holiday season. What's got him down in the dumps?
He's a third-year law student at a law school that's not very good in downtown Washington, D.C., and he's frustrated with the law. He's facing the bar exam, which is not an attractive thing to think about. Mainly, he's heavily in debt. He's borrowed to go to law school. He has a job, he thinks, although the details have not been ironed out. He's just in a funk. He just doesn't feel good. And he goes back to school early, goes back to D.C. early, bumps into his friends. And things deteriorate quickly.
Well, and things are bad back at home, too. His brother, Louis, seems to be intent on ruining his own life.
Louis's a mess. Louis's under house arrest. He wears an ankle bracelet as a monitor, and he's facing trial for drug charges, and there's no way to keep him out of prison. And so his brother's about to go away, and his brother's not a very good guy. His mom is secretly hoping and waiting for Louis to leave with the sheriff. So, yeah, things are bad at home. Things are better everywhere for Mark Frazier.
Now, with a name like Foggy Bottom Law School, you might think it's like an international relations-type law school with the nickname for the State Department.
Who would name a law school, any school, Foggy Bottom? There is a great law school at Foggy Bottom, GW, and it's not this fictional place that I've created for profit. But I couldn't resist the title. Once I decided to set the book in D.C., and it could have been set anywhere, but once I chose D.C., because I kind of live nearby, I had to have Foggy Bottom.
Now, you were willing to drag Princeton into your stories last time around. Why weren't you willing to drag a real school into this one?
Well, Princeton comes off looking pretty good in Camino Island. They don't do anything wrong. the school doesn't. If I had chosen a real school for this story, then that school would be, you know, not well portrayed. And all these for-profit schools are filled with students who are trying to do the right thing, professors who are working for a living, with families and administrators. And I don't want to defame a school. It's much safer for me to fictionalize something.
When you start giving the numbers for tuition and living expenses for these schools nowadays, how does that compare to what you were paying for law school back in the day?
It's certainly a whole lot more. I don't know what I paid at the Ole Miss Law School in 1978 when I started. I finished in 1981. It was a fraction of what school costs now. I didn't borrow any money. I didn't know you could borrow money back then. I mean, it was not – I don't recall a single conversation in 7 years of college with anybody about – borrowing money and going into debt to go to college. Finished debt-free because I didn't know you could borrow. My parents sacrificed. I worked part-time jobs, saved money, lived frugally, and got like all everybody else, and got through law school with no debt. And I never heard of college debt until, I don't know, 20 years ago. I finished 40 years ago, so that was a long time ago. But nowadays, I think almost half of all college students finish with some type of debt. The average debt's $35,000, like $1.5 trillion in student debt, and a lot of it's in default, and it's a crisis.
And, of course, just recently, earlier this week, the Department of Education decided to make it more difficult for students who went to for-profit schools to get some kind of relief from their debt.
The whole mood has changed because when you have a president who started Trump University as a for-profit college, and it went under. He got sued, and he had to settle. You can imagine what his philosophies are about for-profit education. And these schools make a lot of money. They hire big-time lobbyists, and they descend on Washington, and they spread their money around. They get what they want. Student debt's the only debt you can't discharge in bankruptcy. Credit card debt, mortgage debt, business debt, corporate debt, gambling debt, doesn't matter. You can discharge in bankruptcy. If you're bankrupt, you're bankrupt. You can discharge it and start over. Not so with student debt, because the people who sell it got a special law in Congress to protect them from bankruptcy. And so these kids are saddled with unbelievable debts, and they have no relief.
And you talk about how they've privatized the profit, made the risk public.
It's a dream. It's a dream. The profits off the excessive tuition goes eventually to the investors, hedge funds, PE firms, whoever owns these schools. And so they get the money up front. And then years later, when the students default, the losses are socialized because we pick up the price tag.
Now, you also talk about how the job market is kind of soft for lawyers coming out, mm-hmm. very soft coming out, and it seems there's no middle ground. There's the dream that they were sold that they could make $150,000 plus coming out
right.
in the big, the white shoe firms,
right.
and then the other ones are lucky to make $50,000 and they can't repay their debt with that.
There's a big gap, and there are a lot of jobs available for $50,000, government jobs, federal prosecutors' jobs like that, in the 50, 60, 70 range. And you've got the elite firms hiring the top students from the top law schools who are paying this year, I think, $165,000 for Wall Street work. Those will always be there because the big corporations have got to have that type of representation. There's not much in the middle. You don't have many jobs at, you know, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year.
And that seems to be kind of in the economy in general. There's a big divide.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, except, yeah, it's a big divide, except these students have so much debt they can't repay. It's hopeless. They're going to be in default.
Now, he meets up with his buddy Todd Lucero, who tends bar in addition to going to law school. What's Todd's situation?
Pretty much the same. They're buddies, 2.5 years of law school, both of them. Todd doesn't have a job because he hasn't really had time to look for one. The market is so bad, he's not inspired to go knock on doors. He's heavily in debt. He's fed up with law school. They don't see a future together in the law, and they're ready to walk away.
Now, the last time we spoke about Camino Island, I made associations that weren't there of Herb Mann, a character Island being a jazz musician.
Yeah. Right, right.
Memphis Underground. And Lucero is a popular country rock band from Memphis. I just wondered if...
I have no idea. I have no. Strictly coincidental. I have no idea.
Now, Todd and Mark are very worried about their friend Gordy. Of course, he's looking at the same kind of future they are with a soft job market, but he's got things other than law school weighing on his mind.
He has more debt. He has some undergrad debt, and his total figure, I think, is $260,000, $270,000 maybe. He's the top guy as far as debt's concerned. His personal life is a mess. He's cracking up. He's got some problems, bipolar, and going off the deep end. Yeah.
And he literally goes off his meds.
Yeah, he goes off his meds, and we watch him unravel, and it's not very pretty.
And he becomes obsessed with the owner of their law school.
He figures out the scam, who owns the law school, how much money they're making off a string of 8 law schools owned by this one Wall Street investor, and how he also runs a few law firms and uses his law firms for propaganda to entice even more students, unsuspecting students, to borrow even more money, to pay even more tuition for even more profits. So it's a circle. But Gordy did the homework and was able to figure out the scam. And when he did, it pushed him over the edge.
Gordy was seeing a woman that wasn't his fiancée, also a friend of Mark and Todd's, and that's Zola Mall. And her family has legal problems, too.
Everybody's got problems. Zola's parents are from Senegal. They're here illegally. She was born in Newark, New Jersey, so she's an American citizen. Third-year student, similar situation, lots of debt. She was sold the dream. She bought the dream, and she's in the same boat that the guys are. She and Gordy start a relationship that's going to go nowhere. She is the third member of the law school gang once Gordy leaves the story, and they decide they can't finish law school, they don't want to, and they drop out of law school to seek revenge. They're out to get the system.
Enemy number one is the great Satan, Hines Rackley.
Rackley is the hedge fund guy who owns a string of law schools along with banks, shady financial institutions. The guy's just a big crook. And once they figure out how they've been scammed by this guy, they decide to try to go after him.
The book just seems so timely. You probably didn't know how timely it would be with this redoing the rules for student loan relief, with immigration being such a big topic, and then also this week with class action suits against financial institutions being limited.
Yeah, I get my information from the headlines. I just read the newspaper every day and say, okay, who am I going to write about today? If you read some of the activities by various banks in the past 2 or 3 years, they're almost criminal activities. They're hard to believe. How can a big bank with lots of shareholders and wealthy investors and great PR and branches on every corner, you know, how can a bank like that be so crooked? I would read stories about these banks and just take them and stick them in the novel because it's hard to believe.
With banks running in this fashion and then our intrepid trio trying to get revenge, and they might not do that in the most legal way possible, do you think there might be like a revival of the gangster chic of the late 20s and early 30s, like Machine Gun Kelly and Bonnie and Clyde, with people sticking it to the man, as it were?
I doubt if you're going to see that. I would be shocked if that happened. What you're going to see and what you're seeing in ways to get back at the banks, you know, hacking, computer fraud, things like that. They're pretty vulnerable targets.
Earlier this year, you went on tour for the first time in a long time for Camino Island. How did that experience go for you?
It was very enjoyable. I went to 13 bookstores, many of them new stores that I hadn't been to before. Met a lot of writers who did podcasts with me, met a lot of fans who have been buying the books over the years, and it was nice to meet them, to listen to them, talk to them. All in all, it was a very wonderful experience. I did 13 back in June with Camino Isle. I'm going to do 7 with Rooster Bar. Only one book next year, though. 2 books a year is a bit much, 2 big books a year, so I probably won't do that again. I have one book planned for next year, about a year from now, and I plan to tour with it, too, and go to some different areas of the country. It's really fun to go to great independent bookstores around the country and hang out for a while and sell books and meet local writers.
How's the podcasting going for you?
You know, I do them. We record it with the other writers, and then we do a bit of editing, and then we drop them, as we say, broadcast them, post them. I don't really know how you rank these things or how many listeners you have. I don't worry about that. I do it and because I enjoy it and hope it finds an audience somewhere. I think they have.
Do you think your law background helped you with your interview style?
I don't know about that. I've been interviewed so much in the last 25 years. I'm not saying you learn how to do it, but it's a very conversational tone that writers enjoy and the audiences really enjoy.
Well, tonight in Memphis, you're going to have Hampton Sides on with you, so let's take a break and bring Hampton in
with
us.
Sure.
And Mr. Grisham and I are now joined by Hampton Sides, who is a Memphis native and author of best-selling nonfiction books like Hellhound on His Trail and Blood and Thunder. There were some technical difficulties, so Mr. Sides' microphone wasn't operating properly, but we salvaged what was overheard by Mr. Grisham's microphone. Well, Hampton, you're going to be on John's show tonight, and he's going to be interviewing you. Do you have any questions for John first thing
up? It's a dual interview. It's a two-way street. You're supposed to fire questions back and forth, yeah.
Okay, what would you be too embarrassed to ask him in front of other people?
Well, it takes me 3-4 years to do my books, and so my question for you is what's your secret, man? It seems like you have a book every 6 months or so, and I'm so in awe of your productivity, and so is my wife. It's like, well, she's like, why can't I write faster?
Well, but look at what you write, though. Your writing takes so much research. I mean, mine does not. You know, I've read all your books and enjoyed all your books. It's not easy. I've done that one time. I've gone the nonfiction route one time.
Did it take longer?
It took a lot longer, and it took a lot more work. I had to hire a research assistant who worked almost full time, and I was not prepared for what I got into. I'm not a journalist. I don't think of myself that way. I don't know how to interview people and find the evidence and all that. And once I got into it and realized there were just tens of thousands of documents, and there were dozens and dozens of witnesses still alive who I should talk to, it was thoroughly overwhelming. I had a deadline. I had to promise the book, you know, as the next book, and it took a lot longer to write. It was exhausting, and it made me appreciate what you guys do because I don't have the patience for the research like you guys.
Yeah, it really does take a long time. I think it's 3/4 of the process.
Yeah.
Is the getting the stuff, digesting and mining the stuff, you know, having it at your fingertips so you can really use it. That process takes 3/4 of the time.
And then with all that material, then you've got to find a compelling narrative that tells the story. It's all about storytelling. And it's you know, the way you do it and the way David Grand does it, and the way Michael Lewis does it. It's enjoyable. It's popular. But it's also got a lot of research and data behind it.
Since you do write narrative nonfiction, surely there's got to be a little bit of overlap in the skills and the talents you bring to that.
Well, I assume so. I mean, on a certain level, you're telling a story. You know, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, you do need to know how to recognize a good story when you see one.
Yeah.
And understand that it has to have a kind of arc to it. I'm not writing static history about subjects. I'm always looking for a story that kind of has a beginning, middle, and end. And, you know, I want it to read like a novel to the extent possible, with some dialogue and with some sense of character development, and probably some of the same things that you're thinking about with your books go into my nonfiction books as well.
Now, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King next year, and both of y'all were living in the area when the murder happened. I was just wondering if y'all could talk a little bit about your memories of that day and what went on in your minds back then.
I was really young. I really didn't remember much about it. I was 6 years old when it happened. But my father worked for a law firm downtown, Birch, Porter & Johnson, was representing King and some of the garbage workers when King came to Memphis. So I got an earful from him about what was happening. And you could just hear it in the voices of adults, this sense that our city was ripping apart at the seams. It was terrifying to sort of turn on the television and see your hometown, the focus of the nation. My father's best friend ended up being James Earl Ray's attorney early on, so I got an earful from him as well. And that reason I wrote that book, Hellhound on His Trail, is because I really wanted to sort of digest all this information that, you know, I'd kind of gotten passed down from my dad, kind of test it. I mean, this was the pivotal, the electric, controversial, the tragic moment of our city's history, and I wanted to sort of deconstruct it and try to understand it after all these years.
I was 13. We lived in South Haven. My father worked for Tri-State Equipment Company downtown. It was next door to the Lorraine Motel. My dad was in the shop, but he'd been called out on a service call that day. So He was not in the shop, but his coworkers heard the shots that were fired. So that was a connection. I got to be honest. From the way I grew up, where I lived, that society, that very racist, right-wing, you know, Southern Baptist culture I came from, there was no suffering. There was no sadness. King was trying to desegregate our white world. We viewed him not as any kind of a hero. He was the enemy. And that's sadly the way we believed back then. It took a long time for me as a person to appreciate what he did and his courage and what he went through and what he meant to black Americans, because I didn't care. Again, the way I was raised in that segregated world, we didn't care about King. I was a kid. I was able to outgrow it. But sadly, a lot of folks have not outgrown it, you know, in the country.
Did Memphis seem like a different world since you were out in the far suburbs?
Memphis was wonderful because we had lived in various small towns all over the Mid-South. Once we left the cotton farm in Arkansas and we moved around, we moved to South Haven the year before in 67. I was 12 years old. And it was a great place to grow up because all the families were young and there were 90 kids on our street. And it was a fun place to grow up. We had better schools. We had, you know, it was a big moment in our life when we moved here. And we also had Memphis. You know, we had football games at the Liberty Bowl. We had basketball games in the Mid-South Coliseum. We had the Mid-South Fair. You know, we really enjoyed Memphis. My senior prom was at the Peabody before they closed it, you know, almost tore it down. So we were really connected to Memphis. And along the same lines of what happened to Memphis, once busing started around 1970 or so, 71, we were swamped with Memphis kids who were fleeing Memphis and the suburbs of southwest Memphis. Oak Haven, Whitehaven, those areas were changing colors almost overnight. A lot of the families were fleeing across the state line, and they became our friends. But there was a lot of angry bitterness towards what they'd lost their communities, they'd lost their schools, and it really affected politics. And so there's still that confrontational world. Memphis was a rough place in the late 60s, early 70s because of King and what he was trying to do, the assassination, the riots, and then desegregation, busing, and those bad words that they used back then. Federal judges here were under police protection, you know, because they got death threats all the time. It was a very tumultuous time.
In contemporary history, Memphis has kind of been ahead of the curve, and several years ago, the city renamed several city parks that were named after Confederate luminaries. But now the State Historical Commission has prevented the removal of statues to private land. I was just wondering about how you gentlemen think about taking Confederate monuments on a private land that they shouldn't be on public land.
It caused the riots in Charlottesville back in August because the city council voted to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And they changed the name of Lee Park from Lee Park. It's right downtown. It's next to my office. To Emancipation Park. And there's all kinds of litigation. There are lawsuits all over the South right now over this issue. And so we're all trying to come to terms with what's right. Not all of us. Some people know what they want. Black folks want them gone, okay, because it's a symbol of the Confederacy and slavery and all that. I get that, okay. On the other side, you've got people who view it as part of our history and heritage and all that. Those monuments were put up 50 years after the war was over, in the middle of Jim Crow, by people who wanted to glorify the South and Lee and Stonewall Jackson.
Yeah, during the lynching epidemics.
It was Jim Crow, and it was a symbol of white supremacy, okay? That's when they were erected. Lee was not in favor of monuments, okay? Lee didn't want that stuff, and it's kind of sad to see him get trashed in the process. I still have a hesitation with removing monuments because I think you should put up more monuments. You should put up monuments to the slaves who suffered, to the abolitionists who were brave enough to step up and speak, to, you know, tell the whole story. When you start taking down historical monuments, you're almost kind of whitewashing history, and I got a problem with that.
I do too, and I'm, you know, as a historian, you know, you can't pick your history, you can't choose your history,
but you can choose what you venerate.
That's true, and I believe in history. I also believe in democracy, and I understand each generation does kind of need to reinterpret history and figure out what historical movements need to be elevated or sort of perhaps downgraded. Sort of where I draw the line might be Nathan Bedford Forrest. It's kind of the three strikes you're out rule. It's like, you know, okay. He was the largest slave trader possibly in the South just before the Civil War. Then he was a general, massacred a large number of black Union troops. And then he started a thing called the Ku Klux Klan. That's like sort of three strikes, you're out. Yeah. I don't think perhaps we should be celebrating this guy with a public park with his name on it in that way. That, I still don't think the statue should be ripped down or anything like that. I don't believe in vandalism. I think it should be in a park. It should be in a museum or perhaps in a...
Take it over to Shiloh.
A battlefield or a graveyard.
That's a great idea. We have all these federal... Shiloh's my favorite military park. I've spent tons of time at Shiloh as a Boy Scout, and I love that place. And we have all these beautiful parks, federal battlefield parks. Maybe you move them and put them there. So people who are offended by them don't have to see them, and people who do want to see them can go see them. That's a solution that maybe is, too simplistic. I don't have a solution. I think a lot of people, if they could snap their fingers and they disappear tomorrow, we'd all feel better. I'm not sure how much it would improve race relations if they all vanished tomorrow. I'm not sure that's the key. But I understand black folks and their feelings toward those statues. I get that. I'm with them on that.
I had a too snarky idea of putting an extra plaque on all of them that said "Traitor to his country, defeated on the field of battle."
Might make things worse.
I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there's a statue downtown. Some cavalry guy who was active in the wars against, as it says, the savages, and the word savages was excised. I think it's Native Americans or Indians or something like that. But I don't know. It's like everyone knows that it used to say savages. It's just kind of a, it's kind of like a asterisk on this statue. It's kind of silly in the end. Probably need to take the whole thing down. But it's a good question. It's really important stuff that we're kind of wrestling with again. And Charlottesville, unfortunately, was kind of the epicenter of that debate.
We got ambushed. It's a wonderful little town with no very little controversy. And they just descended on us from all areas by the thousands and picked us as their battlefield. And then once the fight was over, they went home. And we were thinking, who were these people? Why'd they come here? But the town's going to be all right. It's a wonderful town, and you know, we're shaking it off. It's going to happen again. You know, these people were so emboldened, especially the alt-right group. They were so proud of what they had done. They loved the attention that they received from Charlottesville, and you know, they're emboldened by it. So it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Now, Hampton, it's about every 4 years in between your books. So is 2018 going to continue that cycle?
Supposed to have a book out in 2018, if I can get it written. It's a book about a battle in the Korean War. It's called The Battle of Chosin Reservoir. It's one of the epic battles, and certainly one of the great battles in the Marine Corps history. It's about what happened in 1950 in the mountains of North Korea when the 1st Marine Division was completely surrounded because of some bad intelligence by over 100,000 Red Chinese soldiers, and they got sort of trapped in the mountains and had to figure out a way to fight their way out. Of course, when I proposed it any number of years ago now, I didn't realize it was going to be a story that would be as current as it's now starting to seem. I'm kind of hoping that events over there don't outrun this process of writing this book. You know, it's heating up fast. But it's supposed to come out in the fall of 2018. It's called The Reservoir.
Did you get a chance to go to North Korea?
No, I tried a couple of different times early on in the process and came close, but I wasn't really interested in just going to North Korea. I wanted to go to the battlefield, and I just could not get permission.
Is the battlefield preserved?
No, not at all. And, you know, there's no statues. Right. I'm talking about statues. It's also very close to where they've been testing nuclear weapons, so it's probably not going to be a place I could have gone. And then what happened to the poor kid from UVA and who was essentially killed over there? At this point, I don't think I'd even want to go. And it's virtually impossible, except certain journalists have been able to go. But I am going to South Korea, and I'm going to China, and I've interviewed a number of Chinese veterans, you know, from their point of view. That's the next project.
Any chance you could speed up? I mean, you know, like every book every 2 years or something?
I know. That's what
your wife says.
That's why I want to get some tips from you on that.
I have no tips. I love your books. I'm going to ask you some questions tonight when we talk about picking the stories. How do you pick the stories? Because they're all great stories. And I started with Ghost Soldiers and one of my favorites, and I just love those stories.
Well, thanks. I mean, you know, it's really hard because you know you're going to be working with that story for years, essentially married to it. It sort of has a rational side and an irrational side. The rational side is, you know, you can check all the boxes. It has good characters. It's got kind of a beginning, middle, end. It's not been written about too much, you know, whatever those boxes are. But then the irrational side is just
there comes a point early on where you have to feel it. You know, it's just like it feels right. Sort of the hair stand up on the back of your neck feeling that.
I feel that way about your story. I just heard it for the first time. I've never heard of that battle. I don't know much about the Korean War. I had an uncle who was killed there from Black Oak, Arkansas. I never met him.
Great band.
They were from there. That's where I was born. But it sounds like a great book to read, so hurry up.
I know. I shouldn't even be here tonight.
Well, Hampton, we're looking forward to that and hope you make it back to Memphis for that as well.
Thanks.
And I want to thank both of you gentlemen for sitting down and sharing part of your afternoons with us.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it.
John Grisham is the author of The Rooster Bar, which is available from Doubleday. Hampton Side's most recent book is In the Kingdom of Ice, which is available in paperback from Anchor. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.